Welcome to the Tournament Poker Edge podcast, brought to you by TournamentPokerEdge.com, the only podcast dedicated exclusively to poker tournament strategy. Now here's your host, Clayton Fletcher.
Hello once again, everybody, and welcome to the Tournament Poker Edge podcast. I'm your host, Clayton Fletcher, in New York City, but I have the bag right here. My suitcase is wide open in front of me as I'm recording this while in the middle of packing for Vegas. My flight leaves within the next 5 hours. So I just wanted to put together a real quick episode for you guys today. The last one before my 2022 WSOP adventure begins. I want to let you guys know I do plan to put out a podcast every week during the WSOP. I'm hoping to, as we have in years past, grab some of the interesting and colorful characters that we might find in Vegas to come on and do interviews with me, talk about hands they played and what their experience has been like, just like we always do during the WSOP. So I want to let you guys know that is the plan. So you can look forward to that. I know I am looking forward to getting on that plane and getting out there and plunking down my first buy-in, a $500 registration into the housewarming. And speaking of the housewarming, the new house is getting pretty good reviews. Now, poker players are notoriously difficult to please. They are big complainers. They always tend to see what's wrong with any given situation. And thus far, the early returns, less than 1 week in, of course, are that the space at Bally's Paris is very nice. Well, actually, it's two separate spaces if you want to get technical. People seem to be happy with everything from the space itself to the chairs. The seating seems to be fairly comfortable. I've heard that the temperature is not as cold as it always was at the Rio. Registration seems to be going very smoothly. Everybody is saying that things are good. Now, it could just be the honeymoon phase right now. We'll see if the players have found a lot more to complain about by week three or four. But yeah, so far, the biggest issue does seem to be parking at Bally's parking garage. Long gone are the days of free parking in Vegas, although there are some hacks that you can use to get free parking if you are so inclined. First of all, if you have any type of card that's not a gold card in the Caesars Rewards program, formerly Total Rewards, you get free parking anyway. In other words, if you're a platinum or a diamond plus or a diamond super plus or a 7-star or 11-star or 700 million star, anything above gold, you get free parking. So that's one thing. If you do any type of gambling, really, even just a moderate amount of degen gambling, you can actually get a platinum card relatively easily. Not that I'm recommending you do so if you otherwise wouldn't, because the odds are if you spend the $20,000 worth of action or so that it would take to get platinum status, on average, you're going to lose more than the $600 that it would cost you to just buy a parking pass every week for 6 weeks. If your math is correct, that is $100 a week gets you a parking pass for unlimited parking at Bally's and Paris. If you don't want to go that route, another hack that I've heard about is that you can just apply for the Total Rewards or Caesars Rewards credit card. I think they have some people hawking those around the property. You don't actually have to use the card. You just have to apply for it. I'm not sure whether you need to be accepted or not, so you might want to check your credit score first. But yeah, I know that people who have the credit card, even if they don't have platinum or higher total reward status, actually get free parking in all of the Caesars properties. So there are ways around this if you're willing to try. There's something else called Founders Card, which I believe costs around $300 and gets you a lot of different benefits, including diamond membership on Caesars. So if you're planning to spend that $100 a week to pay to park at Caesars, you might want to just go ahead and apply for the Founders Card, which gives you benefits such as automatic Diamond membership, American Express miles. There are a lot of different benefits to the Founders Card, which is not a sponsor of this podcast, just something that I've heard about. I'm not actually a Founders Card member myself, but I heard about it from one of my opponents actually in the World Series of Poker, I guess 3 years ago. So this seems to be something you can purchase for $300 or so, and you get a lot of travel benefits, including status at hotels and, of course, Caesars. So that would entitle you to free parking, which right there you can save 50% off the weekly parking fees. So the other issue around parking seems to be a lot of crowds going in and out of the parking garage, the elevators being full, and things of that nature. One thing we will be missing, I think, from the Rio is that gigantic parking lot. Now, to be clear, I very rarely have a car in Vegas, but I know this actually applies more to the locals. But many of you do drive in from places like Arizona or California, and of course, this would apply to you as well. Some casinos do still offer free parking, notably Treasure Island and Casino Royale. So if you're willing to park a bit of a walk away, you can always do that and just make your way down the strip. So I don't know how tilting it would be to walk in the crowd when it's 148 degrees outside just to save a few bucks on parking, but these are the options. And you also won't have the huge crowd in the parking garage, as mentioned. So enough about that, but the early returns are really positive so far. So it seems like Jack Effel and the rest of the crew at the World Series of Poker are getting very good reviews early on. Now, last week we talked about what's in your bag. I want to thank you guys for tweeting me at Clayton Comic and letting me know what you think about essentials that belong in poker players' backpacks. Some of the ones that I did not mention last week that you guys pointed out, many of you mentioned breath mints, deodorant, things of that nature, hand sanitizer, stuff to keep us clean and smelling good and fresh. Remember, we are going to be in close proximity to one another, so it is awfully polite and much appreciated if you don't smell like a sewer in the middle of the summertime. So yeah, obviously you want to keep yourself fresh, and yeah, don't forget your breath mints, a little bottle of mouthwash, something like that, especially when you come back from dinner break. I don't want to smell the onions that you had on your cheeseburger for lunch. So yeah, do that for sure. And then some of you really surprised me with how either superstitious or sentimental you are. Somebody said he brings a lucky rock in his backpack. I don't know. I mean, if the rock brings you luck, then who am I to judge it? But many of you were very sentimental, like pictures of my children, pictures of my wife, things like that. So whatever helps you to kind of stay focused and keep your eyes on the prize, you know, if looking at a picture of your family that you are trying to provide for through your poker endeavors will help you avoid going on tilt, then of course that is something to put into your backpack. I like to also carry an extra pair of headphones and maybe a pair of sunglasses. So those are the things we didn't mention the first time around. But yeah, what else is in your bag? I want to know. I really like this topic, and it's fun to read what you guys are carrying around with you. Obviously, you know, some don't even need to be said, like your ID, your wallet, your money. Of course, you need to bring that with you if it's not on deposit at the cage. All right, so another topic that's been hot lately is, it's kind of putting a dark cloud over the series, if you ask me, because we've had so many positive reviews of the new venue and how they hired so many dealers and how it seems like the WSOP is doing a bang-up job. But where some feel the ball has been dropped is in allowing accused cheaters, Ali Imsirovich and Bryn Kenny, among others, to play in the World Series of Poker. Now, I see both sides of this argument, so I want to share both of them with you. On one hand, it is hard to justify banning these players from the World Series of Poker when they haven't actually been convicted of any crimes. Now, I know they have been banned from GG Poker, and there has been evidence presented in the court of public opinion, aka Twitter, and on Doug Polk's podcast and places like that. But yeah, that's not the same as an actual trial. Now, each of us has his or her own opinion as to the guilt or innocence of these players. And I would say that public opinion is swayed very strongly toward these guys are guilty, along with Jake and all the others that have been named. But, you know, public opinion is one thing, but actually going through what we call here in America due process is quite another. Now, these guys have not been on the witness stand. They haven't had a chance to defend themselves in a court of law. And it would be hard to justify banning them in a country where one is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Now, some of you may be convinced of their guilt, but that's not the same as having that done in a court of law. Now, on the other side of the coin, as I mentioned, I do understand both arguments here. These players have already been banned from other events around the world by websites that have compelling evidence, such as GG Poker and PokerStars, where these players are not allowed to play. So then when they tried to enter live events produced by those very same entities, it was easier for those entities to say, no, you can't play on PokerStars, and you also can't play in the European Poker Tour, the EPT, which is a PokerStars production all around. So that's easier. In a way, it's interesting because this never would have happened if the U.S. government hadn't banned U.S. residents from playing on PokerStars. Then it would be much easier to justify banning these guys from events here in America. But as for the powers that be in the WSOP saying, look, these guys can't be eligible because of something that was decided in Barcelona or Monte Carlo or what have you, that's a kind of far from home. So, I mean, I get both sides of it. I wish that we could do a poker blacklist or whatever and just, you know, have everyone who is seated at my table just be, you know, above reproach. But look, let's be honest, this is the gambling world, and there are going to be some shady characters, some thieves among us, and this is part of the reality of being in poker. But for those who are offended by the very sight of Ali or Brin at Paris this summer, I understand that point of view. So, I mean, I guess where I come down on it is it's a shame that this sort of thing happens, and I will stand enthusiastically cheering with everyone else who revels in each and every Brin Kenny bust out. And now, before we get to the hand that I want to go over today, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about the studying that I've been doing. I'm kind of old school. I like books. You know, I watch all the videos on TPE. My favorite coach, obviously, is Andrew Brokus. He's a friend of mine. He's also one of the best teachers. He's just really good at explaining things and breaking complicated subjects down into their component parts. You can certainly see this on his various video series on Tournament Poker Edge. You can also find it in all of the books that he's written, including Play Optimal Poker and Play Optimal Poker 2. Now, what I like to do is go sit outside the apartment building where I live in New York. We have a little outdoor deck, nothing fancy, but, you know, just some chairs and stuff like on the rooftop, so I can hang out up there on days when it's not too hot and go through the book. I like to do what we call active reading, which is you have a highlighter pen, you have a pencil, so you can take notes in the margin, highlight important things. Active reading ensures that you are really paying attention to each and every word. For many of us, it is difficult to focus 100% on just one thing, but active reading sort of demands that you do so. So that is how I recommend you study. I mean, the first time I read a book, I just read it cover to cover, however long that takes. But then what I like to do is the next time, go through and highlight the key parts, maybe take a few notes in the margin, things like that. And then the third time I read through the book, I will just skim through all of the highlights. So usually one or two highlights per page, and then that will sort of jog my memory about what the rest of the paragraphs are trying to help me learn. So that is my process, and I've learned that it is way more effective than just kind of having a book open while maybe thinking about something else and trying to read that book, but also having your mind wander. We've all done that. I've read pages of a book, whether it's a poker book or even just a work of fiction, where I realized in the middle of reading, like, I don't really know what's happened in the last three pages. So then I need to go back and correct my mistake. So active reading keeps me from doing that. I'm going really deep into Andrew's teachings. And the biggest takeaway for me has been the way it has changed the way my brain sees a poker hand. I now think much more in terms of range versus range, as opposed to what do I actually have in my hand and what do I put my opponent on. If you play range versus range, especially against talented opponents, you are unlikely to make any huge mistakes as long as you understand the theory behind it. Oh, which reminds me, a few of you asked me, and there are no stupid questions, but a few of you have asked me, when I say GTO, what exactly is that? So really quickly, you can fast forward this if you already know, but GTO stands for Game Theory Optimal or Game Theory Optimization. Now, in any game, there is a theoretically best way to play that would be unexploitable. So for example, in the game of tic-tac-toe, you want to start off by filling in the center square with either your X or your O. In the game of baseball, it is theoretically correct to never make the first out at third base, or the third out at third base for that matter. So there are certain things that, you know, can be backed up with math and with statistics and probabilities, but every game has a correct strategy for different situations in which one might find herself through the course of play. So in poker, obviously there are so many different card combinations and an almost infinite number of flops and different turn cards that can come. So the theory is designed, if your opponent makes zero mistakes at all, the best you can do versus that opponent is develop a strategy where your play cannot be exploited. So that's the bottom line. It might not be the most profitable thing to do in a given situation because our opponents do not play perfectly. So very often it's correct to deviate from what a computer simulator, a solver, would tell us to do in the theoretically optimal situation. But knowing what that theory is in the first place helps us to make informed decisions about whether or not to deviate, and if so, by how much, things like that. The more complex the game, the more complex the theoretically optimal solutions. All right, so I hope that answers that. And I'd like to know how you guys study as well. So share your thoughts on studying poker with me on Twitter at Clayton Comic. Let's get into a hand that I played. This is the same tournament that we were talking about last time. As part of my study, I've been trying to apply the theory that I've been learning in practice. And so I played in a $55 PKO on America's Card Room about a month ago. And we reviewed a few hands from this tournament last week. I have one more for you today, and then I'm going to say goodbye and head to the airport. So here we go. We've got blinds of 40,000 and 80,000 with a 12,000 ante per person. And at this point, I had run it up to 6 million. And at that time, I had the chip lead in the tournament with something like 80 players left. So maybe 90 players left. Yeah, because the hand we're about to cover was a few hands after my momentarily occupying the top spot on the tournament leaderboard. But yeah, you know what happens in PKOs many times? You end up having to call off because it's really about collecting those progressive bounties, especially as they get higher and higher, then the value of busting that player becomes very important. And so spots where it might be close, you have to call. So that's kind of what happened to me. I had run it up to 6 million and then lost a few of these little all-in confrontations. I remember one in particular, a player with something like a $100 bounty, which is pretty high for this tournament, had shoved from the cutoff, and I was getting about 1.5 to 1 on a call, holding the king six offsuit. And yeah, normally you could consider folding because those aren't terribly compelling pot odds, but with that huge bounty to win, it's an absolute fist pump call. And he had ace jack, so I basically had two live cards, but I couldn't bust him. And there were a couple of other similar spots where it didn't cost me that much, but a few of these add up, and the next thing we know, we're down to 4 million. But we're fine with 80 players left. We have 4 million in the stack, and the average is only 2.8 million. So we're doing great. We're not in first place anymore, but we still have a healthy stack, and we gave ourselves a shot at some of the bounty prize pool, which is so important to try to get your hands on when you are playing a PKO. So in this hand, the action folds to the cutoff. Now, this is the same guy from last week's episode. A few orbits earlier, when we were also in the big blind, we were in the same situation at a different blind level, and our opponent had raised from the cutoff, and we three bet with ace tray offsuit and took it down. Things have gone pretty well for our aggressive friend here in the cutoff, and he now has us covered. He's got about 4.1 million in his stack, so he's just got a few more chips than what we've got, and he makes it 176K with blinds at 40 and 80. So a little more than a min raise here. And it's the same spot as before. We are in the big blind. This time we have the ace of spades, nine of diamonds. Obviously, it worked before when we three bet him. But this time I decided to just flat and see a flop. And I'll tell you why. I know the solver would probably have a mix between calling and three betting here. Both of us have above average stacks, and I can't bust him, but he can bust me. I don't really want to necessarily inflate this pot. We are about 30-some places away from the money at this stage in the tournament, so that's another consideration. We have to keep that in mind as well. I mean, we're not on the bubble by any means, but considering the type of action that short stacks tend to get in a PKO, it is certainly conceivable that we would be in the money less than 1 hour from now. So we're not that far off from bubble time. Another thing that kind of went into my thinking here is that how much abuse is this guy willing to take? Like, what if he starts four betting light because it feels to him like I always three bet when he opens from the cutoff and I'm in the big blind? You know, you're more experienced opponents will start to adjust their game if they feel like you're trying to take advantage of their mistakes, etc. And do we really want to get into a raising war against this player holding just ace nine? I don't know. I don't feel like that's a good idea. This hand's a little too weak for me to want to play a 100 big blind pot with it pre-flop all in. So I just decided to call. You could certainly quibble with that and you would have a point. It probably merits a three bet, but in this situation, I decided to just go ahead and see a flop. So we call, and now with 488,000 in the pot, the flop comes the ace of diamonds, queen of clubs, deuce of diamonds. So ace, queen, deuce with two diamonds, and hero with the ace nine offsuit. And note that we do have the nine of diamonds. So we check, as I always will in this situation, when you're heads up, out of position, and you're not the pre-flop raiser, you pretty much should always check. I mean, some solvers will have you leading in a heads-up situation maybe less than 1% of the time. So for all intents and purposes, we can just go ahead and check all of our range, even when we have top pair. I check, and he bets 141 into 488. Obviously, a very small bet here. It makes a lot of sense. He shouldn't need to use a big sizing in this situation, whether he's bluffing or not. He has a range advantage, a nuts advantage. He has all the advantages, an equity advantage, EV advantage, however you want to look at it. He has the advantage on this ace high flop. So just because we checked, he should pretty much always bet whether he has an ace or can beat an ace or has nothing. So it's a good flop for him and for his range. And he bets 141. No reason to go crazy here. We just call and see what happens on the turn. So now, with 771,000 in the middle, the turn comes the five of clubs. So we check again. You do have more of a case for leading on this turn card now that the board has two diamonds and two clubs. Remember, it's ace, queen, deuce, five with two diamonds on the flop and now backdoor clubs on the turn starting to develop. So there are more draws available now than they were before. There is a case to be made for leading. And if we lead, I think we should lead around the same sizing that this opponent used. He bet 619 into 771. So yeah, it's a very large bet, 85% of the pot or so. I would support this bet sizing if we chose to lead as well, which we should do with very strong hands, such as a straight, like if we have four tray and we made a wheel, a set, perhaps pocket deuces, pocket fives, two pair, a hand like ace five or ace deuce. And then, of course, if we pick up a draw, it's fun to go ahead and include that as a semi-bluff so that we can make those bigger bets when we have monster hands on 4th Street. So we just have top pair with a mediocre kicker. And at this point, when this opponent makes such a large polarizing bet, we actually have a bluff catcher. And it's important to recognize that. I liked my hand a lot more on the flop when my opponent bet like a quarter pot than when he bets so much on the turn. That said, I'm not about to fold ace nine, not yet anyway. So now with 2 million in the middle, we're going to see a river, and it comes the tray of hearts for a final board of ace, queen, deuce, five, tray, with two flushes that missed and none that got there. Note that any four has a straight. What to do? Well, I mean, we can certainly lead this river. I believe that we now have a nuts advantage. I think that the calling range should have more fours in it than the raising range, but it's kind of not credible for us to try to convince this opponent that we have a four. And we also have showdown value. There's still a relatively strong chance that ace nine is the winner in this spot. So for those two reasons, I decided not to bet. But if you want to lead this river and turn your hand into a bluff, I think that is certainly a defensible play. But note that you will often get looked up when our opponent has a hand like ace king or ace jack, because so many draws have missed. I know one kind of weird backdoor straight draw got there, but yeah, this is not enough to balance two different flush draws that did not. Not to mention all of the combo draws and gut shot broadways that also missed. So I opted to check, and we're hoping that villain checks behind and we can just see without losing any more chips, we can find out if ace nine is any good. My plan in checking this river was if our opponent again polarizes himself with another very large bet on the river, I think that I was planning to fold my ace nine because I didn't expect this opponent to fire another huge barrel with a hand that can't beat ace nine. I thought that his bluffs would be a smaller bet a lot of the time because he's trying to get me to fold medium strength hands like a queen or a missed flush, right? Anywhere from a medium strength to a no showdown type of hand is what his bluff target should be. I don't think that he would be trying to push me off an ace. So my thinking at that point was, Let's call if he bets small or medium and fold if he bets big. And you kind of have to have that type of strategy when you are playing online. Now, live, I can sort of get a feel. Is he bluffing? Does he feel strong? Do I sense weakness? And I can make close decisions that way. But yeah, I was not happy to see the bet sizing that my opponent came up with, 822,000 into 2 million. So it's a small-ish bet, a little more than 40% of the pot, which is not a very common sizing for a river bet. You generally want your river bets to be very large, like pot size, or maybe even a little bit bigger. And then some of them can be very small, like one third of the pot or even smaller. But yeah, we kind of want to stay from this middle of the road bet sizing on the river, generally speaking. So for me, this was kind of a head scratcher. I really didn't know what to do with it, but I decided to just follow through with my plan and make the call. Our opponent turned over pocket queens, so it was a flopped set. And had the river card not been a tray or another card that might scare me off, I think that this opponent may have tried to bust me and collect my bounty, which was either $48 or $58 at that point. So, yeah, not insignificant by any stretch. Yeah, but I don't think that he can make such a large bet with just a set when that particular card comes in. Because I now have to fear that he might have made a straight and I can't pay off with a hand like ace nine. Overall, I think my opponent played this hand very, very well. And he got about as much as he was going to get out of me, especially with that clever and unusual river sizing. I went on to finish in 14th place in this tournament, collected about $800 or $900. From playing it, I really enjoyed the experience. I love bounties, PKOs, mystery bounties, straight ahead bounties, super bounties, whatever kind of bounty you want. I intend to be playing quite a bit of multi-table bounty tournaments in fabulous Las Vegas in the next 2 months. That'll do it for this episode. Thank you guys for your continued support of this podcast, and I'm looking forward to seeing all of you out there at the World Series of Poker. And for everyone here at Tournament Poker Edge, I'm Clayton Fletcher. Thank you so much for listening.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please. Fold them, let them hit me, raise it, baby, stay with me. Luck and intuition, play the cards with babes to start. And after she's been hooked, I'll play the one that's on her heart.
Yeah.